And then you can think of transformational innovation. And this is where you're really disrupting multiple different business models simultaneously. And this is where you sort of see like Netflix come into place, where people would go into Blockbuster Video, they'd get a video, and that seemed to be the way. And now you have business lines and ways of doing things completely different. And I'm using business examples because they're tangible, but it's the same thing in healthcare. We used to do big surgeries on people's valves and coronary artery disease, and now you can use...
Welcome to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Mark Bonta, a podcast that examines health issues with a critical eye grounded in scientific skepticism. Disclaimer: the Ditch the Lab Coat podcast is no different than sitting in on a conversation between healthcare professionals at a cocktail party. It is intended to be a fun and informative listening experience that gives all of our listeners a chance to make sense of the fascinating world of medicine. It is a podcast. It is not a substitute for professional medical services, does not establish a doctor-patient relationship, and the use of the information from the podcast or linked materials is at the user's own risk. Basically, if you have a headache that just won't go away, or if your fingers are turning blue and falling off, go to your local emergency department, urgent care center, or see your primary care doctor or nurse practitioner. The content does not aim to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The expressed opinions belong solely to the hosts and guests, and they do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hospitals, clinics, universities, or any other organization associated with them. So plug in, enjoy, and get ready to expand your knowledge of all things medical by listening to our fun, evidence-based, and practical conversations. But if your hair falls out after listening to the show, go see a medical professional and don't file a lawsuit against me or my guests. Welcome back to another episode of Ditch the Lab Coat. We have a truly exceptional guest joining us in the studio today. He's not just a doctor, he's a visionary, a catalyst for change, and a true pioneer in the realm of healthcare innovation. Allow me to introduce you, Dr. Dante Mora, a name synonymous with transformation and progress in Canadian healthcare. Dr. Mora isn't just another physician, he's a physician executive with a remarkable track record of not just imagining a better healthcare system, but actually making it happen. As the president of Trillium Health Partner Solutions and the chief clinical innovation officer at Trillium Health Partners, a giant hospital in Ontario, Canada, Dr. Mora has spearheaded initiatives that have reshaped the landscape of healthcare in Canada. His leadership has led to the creation of innovative hospital networks, such as the Institute for Better Health and the groundbreaking CanHealth Network, which are driving practical research and facilitating the scaling of Canadian medtech companies. But Dr. Mora's impact doesn't just stop there. He's a professor of medicine at Temerty Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto and has been recognized as Professor of the Year an astonishing 5 times. His commitment to excellence in teaching and clinical practice has earned him multiple awards for clinical excellence, solidifying his reputation as a leader in both academia and healthcare delivery. Now let's dispel a misconception about Dr. Mora's field of expertise. Despite the incredible advancements in medicine, diagnostic errors still pose a significant challenge. Dr. Mora recognizes this, and his work aims to address and mitigate these errors, ensuring that patients receive the accurate and timely diagnosis that they deserve. And if you thought his professional achievements were impressive, wait until you hear about his personal endeavors. When he's not revolutionizing healthcare, Dr. Mora is conquering triathlons and even embarking on adventures like Everest Base Camp Expedition this spring, 2024. I've known him for a very long time, and he's a very positive, solutions-focused individual. And what I love are his analogies, not only in healthcare, but I remember when I was becoming a new parent, he had an approach to dealing with a temper tantrum, an approach to dealing with the child who won't go to sleep. He has an approach to heart failure, an approach to systems innovation, an approach to everything. He's wonderful to speak with, and I hope that everybody in our listening audience will find him very interesting, very thought-provoking, and also very positive about the future in healthcare that we have coming forward. Without further ado, let's hop into the studio and let's welcome Dr. Dante Mora. What's interesting, Dante, is I get a newspaper in Canada, the Globe and Mail, every Saturday delivered. And every few months on Saturdays, there's a Report on Business, which is a magazine about business executives. And it kind of talks about like the who's who's in the business world, CEOs and VPs and all these kind of multimillionaires. And in 2022, you were listed as one of the top 50 executives in Canada, but you're a specialist in internal medicine. So how did you land on a list of people who are business executives as a doctor?
It's a long and sort of windy journey, but I think it starts off with what motivated me to become a doctor. So I always wanted to improve health and reduce suffering. That's what motivates me. And so I started doing that as a doctor with individuals, and I still practice and get a huge amount of satisfaction. And as practicing as a doctor, the privilege of doing that, I so value. But then what started to happen was I started noticing system problems early on in my career, whether that's how we educate medical students or how we collect blood work or how we work with IT systems. And so what happened through a variety of different roles was larger and larger leadership roles with more responsibility, with more complexity, trying to improve healthcare. And when that report came out, I had just done a large hospital merger with Trillium Health Partners and helped it move from a community organization into an academic organization and led through COVID, everything from vaccine to implementing IT systems. So it really comes from wanting to improve health and having a propensity to not look away from problems. And that's sort of what motivates me. And I've had a lot of great people who have supported me in that journey.
And so a lot of your work not only has been managing large institutions and managing people within those institutions, right, as chief of staff, you had to manage the various physicians who reported to you, but it's been about driving innovation. And when you worked at another large Toronto hospital, Toronto General Hospital, you worked for the Center for Innovation and Complex Care. And then you've gone on to create bigger and larger scale investments as it pertains to innovation. So what is innovation in healthcare to you? Is it having ChatGPT help doctors? Is it helping people be monitored in the home environment? Is there one way to describe what innovation is in healthcare?
Yeah, so if you go into the more science of innovation, you can think about it really about the first adoption or the first scale of new things. And what's interesting about healthcare is it's usually about 20 years behind every other industry. So I did a lot of work on lean process improvement in the 2000s in healthcare, but manufacturing had already been revolutionized by lean process improvement in the 1980s. You can think about innovation as in just doing new things, and you can think about that as core things. So a nurse finds a better marker to write on a whiteboard, and that becomes the standard across a hospital, and that's very core, simple innovation. And then you can think about adjacent innovation, and that's offering new services to existing clients, and that's sort of like Uber Eats. So you have Uber, and then they're suddenly like, wow, we can deliver food. And then you can think of transformational innovation. And this is where you're really disrupting multiple different business models simultaneously. And this is where you sort of see like Netflix come into place, where people would go into Blockbuster Video, they'd get a video, and that seemed to be the way. And now you have business lines and ways of doing things completely different. And I'm using business examples because they're tangible, but it's the same thing in healthcare. We used to do big surgeries on people's valves and coronary artery disease, and now you can use angioplasty or catheters to open up vessels, which completely changes the number of cardiovascular surgeries you do. So you can get innovation in many different ways, but usually it's about disrupting business models. And that can be very simple, led by frontline, or that can be quite transformational, where you're using technology and business processes in a completely different way.
So a lot to unpackage there, right? Like innovation is change to me, and that could be someone using a different marker, like you identified with the nursing staff, to this kind of transformational change, like overhauling entire systems. And I've worked in large hospitals with many layers, right? Complex corporate institutions. And when you mentioned that you merged a large community hospital with academics, you know, that means bringing in research, bringing in residents, bringing in medical students. So a whole different way of running business. And I've also worked in smaller rural environments where I work right now, which is a smaller community hospital. And in the larger hospitals, you know, you have a lot more support and a lot more money and a lot more interest in these big changes.
but it's slow. You have to make a lot of people happy. You have to go through a lot of different committees. There's a lot of different steps and layers. But when I look at creating change in a smaller or rural hospital, there's a lot more, hey, that's a great idea. Let's just do it. And a lot less resistance, but the supporting models and the structures are not there. And so innovation is something that's difficult to do in different environments. But when you referenced Blockbuster, so I think about Reed Hastings, right, who ran that company and said, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to mail people DVDs. And Blockbuster said, good luck, buddy, right? And those two CEOs kind of went at it. And sure enough, everybody has Netflix now, right? And we're no longer mailing DVDs to our houses, but we're streaming whatever we want. We're streaming games. We're doing everything. But this was a private business, right? Reed Hastings, when he started the company, said, I think this will be different. And a lot of businesses fail. He took on a lot of risk. He came up with something that was very different than the normal way of doing business, right? Who's going to not want to go into a brick or mortar Blockbuster and hold that movie on Friday night and get some of that free popcorn and go home? Who's going to want to have a DVD mailed to them? Well, he proved them all wrong. And that's how we do business right now. But none of those layers were there. And if this guy lost millions of dollars, I don't know where he got his investment money from, you know, angel investors, all that kind of stuff, the company would be bankrupt and it would be just a story later on. But you can't take that risk in healthcare, or can you?
Well, I think we do, and we can, and it depends, right? So like the interesting thing about working in a small hospital is you can do small tests of change. It might be harder to scale it to everyone because you might not have the machinery to do it. And you might not have the infrastructure. So if you don't have implemented like significant like data systems or IT systems, it really is hard to play in the AI game because your legacy systems aren't as strong. In healthcare, when you run a big organization, what's so interesting, and Mark, I know you know this because of the work that you do as an internist, is people are harmed every single day in a hospital. Like there, it is a dangerous place. That doesn't mean that the providers and the organizations, they want it to be safe and want to provide care, but people slip, fall, get infections, have complications, have many adverse events. So the risk of not bringing in technology and doing things in a new way, it's a significant risk. And it's just managing that risk. And so that's something that I've become, I think, quite good at doing, is understanding how to change small environments and large environments to understand how to change the paradigm of where the risk really lies, and then help lead people through that. And then also understand how technology can work, because technology looks stupid in the beginning. Like you see Michael Douglas from Wall Street on the beach with the giant cellular phone, that it's like nobody's ever going to use that. But then there's the iPhone moment where the iPhone is, or the smartphone, everybody has it because it's the battery's good enough or the technology's good enough that it hits the inflection curve. And it's just, that was the same thing with Netflix. Everybody thought mailing DVDs was stupid, but then actually what they were doing is getting to a customer-centric model. Healthcare is the same way. Healthcare does not make sense right now. You're sick, you go to a waiting room, you get other people sick, you can't get to your doctor when you're sick, you have to travel, you're always waiting, can't get access. Nobody's actually trying to make you healthy. And that's not because the people are evil or stupid, it's just because that's the way the system's designed. So healthcare is going through a disruption right now. It's going to take a while, and healthcare is a big thing. It's everything from wellness to taking care of car crashes. But it is disrupting, and technology will disrupt it, and businesses will have important stakes in that, and so will organizations. And there'll be winners and losers, as there always is in any technological change.
But what if the stakes are so much higher? You talk about managing risk. So what if I come up with a disruptive idea similar to Netflix and Blockbuster? And I say, you know what? This work from home stuff's pretty nice, right? I learned that during COVID. I'm doing that right now. I'm sitting at home. I'm wearing my shorts. I'm talking to you on a microphone. When I'm done this, I can go flip the laundry. You know, it's great. Why don't patients who come into hospital, and I predominantly do inpatient medicine as an internist and intensivist, why don't, when they come into hospital, their families stay with them? They know them best. They can help them. And then I have a robot who watches them on virtual reality, and I can see everything that's happening, and I can direct the family to, oh, that IV looks blocked. Just give them that little syringe and inject it into that little port there. Oh, you got it. It's going to fix it. And I'm going to monitor my patients remotely, and I'm going to prescribe things. And I say, you know what? I think this is going to help, because then I can look after a lot of people all over Ontario at the same time. I'm not going to expose myself to illness.
I'm going to be able to empower patients and their family members to take care of their diseases and perhaps send them home sooner, right? This sounds like a great idea, but those stakes are high. So if I screw up, we're looking at people dying and people getting sicker. So when you look at the stakes being that high in risk mitigation, does that lead that even though there is disruption in healthcare, the disruption is delayed relative to private industry where the risk is just your company goes bankrupt and not a whole bunch of people die?
Yes. So this is all happening right now. So we have like ICUs in smaller communities hooked up to ICUs in bigger communities. We have people doing virtual rounds in nursing homes, supporting family doctors. We have radiologists reading scans from far away. We have psychiatrists doing counseling with people that would never be able to have access to those things. So it's already happening. But the real reality of healthcare is that people don't actually see where the risk is and where the damage is. So it's usually quite hidden. And whereas like for the aviation industry, when somebody dies and a plane falls out of the sky, it's obvious. Everybody rallies around it and sort of says it's never going to happen again. Whereas in healthcare, somebody comes in, they get an infection in a catheter, and they have a 20% chance of having a chronic infection or dying or having morbidity. You know what? There's things out there that can actually improve your risk of infection. There's a great company led by an amazing entrepreneur, Karen Mueller, which almost reduces catheter infections to zero, but it's more expensive. And so in any public, in a model where it was rational, that technology would be rapidly adopted and that technology scaled. And it is starting to scale and that's some of the work that we do. But it's partly because the risk and costs are hidden in different ways in healthcare and the complexity of the marketplace. But it is changing. Healthcare is not immune to change. It is changing. It is more complicated because people would always take the status quo of risk over new risk. And I've seen this in multiple pieces of work that I've done, like implementing IT systems and putting keyboards into an Emerge. And they're like, well, do those keyboards meet the infection control risks of? And I'm like, guys, there's already computers there. Like, why do my new keyboards have to have a higher test than every other keyboard already there? So it's just fascinating. But that is understanding healthcare innovation. You have to really understand risk. It's a high risk business. People's lives are there and everybody's different. This is where things like the military were at risk or even aviation. When you go to sit in an airplane, most people actually operate almost the same. Whereas when you come into healthcare, you're almost completely different. So dealing with someone having a baby on a planned or on a model like that or a surgery or someone coming into the Emerge who has, you know, cirrhosis, Alzheimer's and homelessness at the same time with an infection, there's a high degree of input variation, which people don't often understand with innovation.
Yeah, I can relate to the airline industry. You know, now that we have social media, TikTok and Instagram, you see those videos of people going crazy. You know, people going crazy on the airline hosts and then being restrained in the plane lands and people bringing emotional support boa constrictors. It's insane. So I can totally relate to that.
And that happens in healthcare, right? Like when you're in hospital, you're not at your best. Like our staff take a tremendous amount of abuse and it's hard. So if you're you're delirious, you're sick, you're coming from anesthetic and you say something to a nurse or a doctor or you hit them, it's very complicated. And that's why healthcare is one of the last industries to be disrupted. It's its size and its complexity, but the importance of it. When I say disrupted, I mean it in a good way. I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean it adopting the most up-to-date principles of how to run operations and how to use technology in the most sophisticated ways.
So there's got to be some one-size-fits-all technologies, you know, electronic health records. Like, doesn't matter if you're 90 and you have some mild Alzheimer's and liver cirrhosis, or if you're 16 and have strep throat but no other issues. An electronic health record system is a one-size-fits-all technological implementation or innovation. Are there other one-size-fits-all implementations in healthcare that are pretty easy to scale because it works for everybody, it makes sense?
I think where you're starting to see a real change is in how people are using their own data. So everything from pulse oximeters, and that's a very simple technology that you can stick on anyone and it can transmit data that a while ago was impossible. Like getting your heart rate and your blood oxygenation. And like, these were things that were really hard to do. You could only do in a hospital. And so what I think you're going to start to see is around diagnosis, where it's actually democratized a little bit, where you can get virtual stethoscopes, ultrasound, blood tests done very easily. And we already have seen this in places. So before, you'd think that you were pregnant and you'd go to your doctor's office to see if you're pregnant. And now there's pregnancy tests in every pharmacy. So the diagnosis and capturing of biometric data is going to completely change the way that it works. And then you're going to start seeing that data being pushed through different engines to provide you support at a whole different way. And if you like wearables and you have the Oura Ring or other things, you start to see these interesting nudges where they're collecting data and they're running algorithms helping you know what to do in the best way. That is just the beginning. So you're going to see technology happening in both the big places like hospitals, which honestly is less interesting. That's going to go through an interesting process. But on the personal side, you're going to see a complete change in how people are able to take care of their health. And the simplest way to describe that is there was a time you drive down the highway and your wheel would basically explode and you'd go to the side of the road. Now, if you drive a more modern car, there's a little light that goes off and says, there's something wrong with your tire. Or go to the mechanic. And so you go to the mechanic and they're like, oh, your oil pressure's this, your tire's this, there's a nail in your tire, and they fix it. That's what's going to happen. So this concept of the only time you go to the hospital is when you're sick, you're going to be monitored. And then we're going to be able to say, hey, Mark, we're a little bit worried about this about you. You need to go here, or we're tracking your vaccination or your major guidelines with these algorithms. And that is going to dramatically change how healthcare works.
There's a lot to unpackage there. And I look at wearables, and you mentioned earlier the inflection point. So there's a large group based out of, I think it was Multicenter, that published some interesting findings at an American Cardiology conference last week with the values of remote monitoring for people with congestive heart failure. So congestive heart failure is when you get water in your lungs, and ironically, you give them a water pill to make them urinate. And you give them all these other medications. And heart failure is not that your heart's failed and it's quit on you. It's just not working as well. It might be too stiff, a little weak. The valves might be old. So there's ways to treat that. And heart failure as a diagnosis in hospital is really costly all throughout the world. And I know the statistics in Canada are, we spend close to $1 billion in Ontario on people who we just can't get better well enough, and they get sicker when they go home and they come back to hospital. The whole question is, isn't this preventable? We have good old-fashioned things like measuring someone's weights at home, measuring their blood pressure, measuring their oxygen level to say, uh-oh, you're filling up with fluid. So let's give you some more medication to help you get to the point where you need to be hospitalized. And so this large group actually looked at remote monitoring of all of those variables, right? Blood pressure, oxygen, weights. And it helped to ping remotely to a team of doctors, nurses, and pharmacists when people needed attention and adjustment to their medications. You could correlate that with their blood work and make sure that you're doing good things for them to avoid their need to come back into hospital. So there's an example of something being done well with remote monitoring. But I deal with the other side too. Friends and family members at social functions and parties showing you what their smartwatch told them was wrong with them, or telling you what their oxygen and breathing rate is at night and their quality of REM sleep. And I'm like, I don't even know if like you can measure REM sleep remotely. And like, who cares that you were breathing at 8 respirations per minute when you were like, there's so much data there that I think is useless. And then there's so much data that is good if it's put in the right hands. And when I look at the patient population that I care for with the diagnosis of heart failure, in general, kind of technology literacy is a spectrum. English as a second, third, fourth language, the dexterity to manage these remote apps, even having a data plan or Wi-Fi or cell phones. So when you look at these studies that do it well, they often have that infrastructure and that support to make sure that patients don't fall through the cracks. But when I look at the patients who actually need this, I don't know if it's going to get to them. And I don't know how much usable information is coming out of these wearables. So based on your experience, do you see that we're almost at that inflection point where we'll finally figure out what usable information we have out there, and we'll have the means to curate it for people who need it and negate the need for them to have to check in remotely or have to work technology, but it's just kind of autopilot? Like, how far are we off from that?
Yeah, I think we're actually already there. We're at that iPhone moment or that like exponential adoption moment. So you have a convergence of everything from virtual technology and business models of how you align your doctors and nurses to technology that does pick up information, but it's still a really big cell phone. Getting back to the Michael Douglas model of Wall Street, if maybe that's too far away, but it's not adoptable for everybody, but we're getting very close and it's already happening with different groups like heart failure groups and other groups where you can actually prevent people from getting into hospital by capturing data and then wiring that to easy behavioral nudges and then connectivity with nurse practitioners and doctors and then rescue with other people. So you have to align that business model. So it, like in your example, as an internist, you know, you go in, you take care of 20 inpatients, and that has a really important impact. And there is that something about the therapeutic relationship of being physically there that's very important, particularly in hard moments. But if I said to you, Mark, I'm going to take the 1,000 sickest people in Collingwood and the ones with the highest amount of readmissions and risk, and we're going to connect them with some simple wearable technology and remote technology that we have now, wire it into a very simple technological database and use you as the end of a call center where we put a nurse in front of you and we're going to monitor these people and we're going to nudge them to good behavior. And then the nurse practitioner or the nurse will take care of most of the inquiries and you're only going to take the hardest questions. That's probably the best use of your time because you're going to have a huge impact on wellness and people and prevention. But you have to then align the business model, the payment model, the technological model, the consumer model. And that conversion is all happening and it's starting, the technology's there. It's a lot on sometimes the business and payment models. And that's what innovation is. Sometimes the technology is available, but you have to change the way payment happens or the way that other parts of the different types of innovation happen. So hopefully that helps.
But there are people out there that I feel, regardless of how well we can monitor them remotely, they're so complex and so sensitive. You know, they have multi-system organ dysfunction. They might be on dialysis, right? Kidney replacement therapy. I see people who take 30 or 35 medications a day and you get the slightest change in dose in someone with kidney dysfunction. And all of a sudden it's a toxic range and they're sick from that. Are we ever going to change these complex, sensitive patients from their utilization of hospital-based resources? Or is that always going to be something we live with?
Yeah, there's always going to, you know, like I always think about the homeless, cirrhotic liver failure patient who's got cancer, who's on chemotherapy and has dementia. Like that's a real patient, by the way. Like that's not fictitious. So taking care of that patient is extremely complicated outside of a hospital. But then there's everything in between. And when you discharge somebody, if you have the right structure around it, you just decrease the utilization. But ultimately, what the hard part of healthcare is we all mentally or physically break down at the end of our lives, right? It is an inevitable truth, at least with the current technology that we have. Although, you know, who knows on the anti-aging stuff, there's a whole domain of changing aging. But at the end, we all break down either mentally or physically. Or we have an event, like an episodic event, like a car crash or something. So at those very, very high complexity spots, so that's when you need hospitals. But there's a whole bunch of people, everything from somebody who's not getting their vaccines, that we could nudge them to get their vaccines, to helping their cholesterol, that entire complexity pyramid of the top of the pyramid being the most complex, but the vast majority of the population sits in the bottom part and we can make a huge change there. And what's always interesting to people is 5% of the population uses almost 70% of the healthcare resources. And that's not because they're bad people or they're going to the emerge when they don't need to. That's just because they're really complicated and they're difficult patients. The reality is the healthcare is changing and technology is being adopted. And it's a really exciting time to be in healthcare. Healthcare is changing in many different ways. Like it's everything from changing the aging process. So you'd rather smoke 2 packs a day than be 60 years old. Smoking is like the most important thing that you shouldn't do if you're going to improve your lifespan and your health. But aging is like the highest predictor of cancer and other illnesses. So if you can actually start to change the dynamics of aging, which I think we will start to get work there, then you start getting things that are actually taking care of you, like that light on your car that's saying, instead of you getting sick, it's actually saying, this is what you need to do to be healthier. This is what you need to do, avoid. And then you get into technology and hospital systems and abilities to take care of very like chronic diseases. And then you get into like the transplant revolution, which will happen, where we're printing organs. You start to see a very, very different world emerging. And healthcare will move in that direction. Some things will be very quick and some things will be very far. And it's like any technology. It starts off where we're going to have self-driving cars and everyone thinks we're going to have self-driving cars and EV cars tomorrow. And it looks near, but it's far. But it does happen over time in the same way that people didn't have smartphones and now everybody has smartphones. And it surprises you once it gets to the exponential part of the curve. So within healthcare, it's a really exciting time to be in healthcare because as an innovator and operator, what's happening is a lot of change within the system. And there's sometimes some bad things about that, but there's a lot of good that can come from that as well.
So there's two things that my mind needs your opinion on. And the first thing is where the innovation is going to come from. And I'm thinking about when you mentioned anti-aging and what people are doing out there. So I know you work in public healthcare, right? In a publicly funded system in Canada, which I think is great, right? Obviously, it's kind of on life support right now. But the goal is to help all of our patients. So it's more about looking at which people are in need and let's help them, right? It's not a private business enterprise looking at how can we make money. And when you look at where innovation comes from, you know, there's always this analogy that innovation on the internet and video streaming comes from the porno industry, right? Like they drove that, they created quick streaming and virtual interactions, and that drove that innovation. And I think about what I'm seeing on my social media, on Instagram, on TikTok, and even popping up on LinkedIn, which are private enterprises who are selling this whole monitoring system predominantly to well-rich people in their 20s to 40s, frankly. Like you can put all your data in here and all your blood work and your DEXA scans and your MRIs. They like saying these fancy words and it can plug into a model just like ChatGPT to make sure you're on the right track. We all know that if you're in your 20s and you're taking care of your body and you don't have any chronic diseases, you don't need blood work. You don't need a DEXA scan, which is a bone scan for osteoporosis. So this is all useless stuff, but these people selling it sound very convincing that if we have these MRIs, if you're getting monthly full body MRIs and blood tests, we're going to prevent you from getting the big casino, right? The big cancer and dying. So subscribe to this service, right? It's all for pay, for profit models that are looking to make companies and shareholders rich, right? These aren't companies that are out there to fix the homelessness issue, right? Kind of more of the driving principles in a Canadian healthcare system. But do you see some of these side ventures actually helping our need and your work in innovation in Canadian healthcare models that maybe they're onto something and maybe, who knows, maybe you do need to get bone scans every month when you're in your 20s and that'll prevent cancer in your 60s. Like, who knows? Do you think any innovation is going to come from all these private businesses that's going to drive growth in our public system?
Yeah. So one of the things I founded was, it's called the Can Help Network, which uses the existing healthcare system to scale up Canadian commercialization. And it does everything from back office transformation of HR systems for nurses and doctors to actually putting devices into people's bodies that localize cancer for radiation and all Canadian companies. And so what I really believe will happen, my values, and I'm not saying these are the right values, but my values are, I believe that I want to work on health and suffering for all Canadians and for the world. I don't think it should be completely distributed that only a very small portion of the population gets everything and the rest gets nothing. That's not the way I think about the world. I think about the world as you have to reward people for risk that they take, but then you actually have to distribute the value to everybody. So that's how I see the world. But what I do believe is that most of the disruption and the change is going to come from outside of the public system. And there are incredible companies like Nanotests out of Calgary that are doing amazing work with wound care with nanotechnology. I talked about Karen Mueller from Sterile Care that has created a catheter solution that almost completely gets rid of catheter infections. And Mark, you know how serious those are for everything from dialysis to cancer. And there's a whole industry, even a company like Myint, that's working on the bio-digital interface through clothing that completely transforms how we will interface with healthcare. So I do believe it'll come. And when you're starting to see this world where there's a lot of change, there's always going to be charlatans. There's always going to be people who will say, take this and it'll cure everything, or this will solve everything. That's always been capitalism. There's always risk at that. And we're at a really interesting moment because you're seeing some people say, here's the right thing, and it's probably not. And they're talking about things that are probably not true. But then you're seeing some really substantial technological change that will become the new standard. And most of it will come from, I believe, the commercial models that come from private investment. And then they'll be adopted by the public system. And when you talk about wealth distribution, like in the 1920s or in the beginning of the car, the only people who had a car were people who were extremely rich. So it's not uncommon for technology or access to things to be unevenly distributed. What governments do and what societies do is then determine how we deliver those services to everybody and those people with the least amount of voice. So I believe in policy that does that, but I also believe you have to drive up commercial innovation. And I believe that's where you're seeing most of the action. That's why we created Can Health. And that's why we're seeing, we've seen a lot of adoption in the Canadian marketplace. And I think Canada can help lead that new healthcare economy, which is an important part because that keeps jobs in Canada, which is important. And I think that's where a lot of the energy will come from.
Have you heard about the radiologist boat?
No, but I can imagine what it is.
I don't know if this is true, but you mentioned kind of virtual monitoring and remote monitoring and radiology. When I was training in medical school, geez, almost 15 years ago, a lot of tests were still printed film. Like, so if you think back to the Polaroid, an X-ray or an MRI was pieces of paper or film, and a radiologist would look at them, right? They'd look at it, they put it up just like on Grey's Anatomy against that fluorescence.
Yeah, totally. We would lose the films. Like, we would carry them around.
Yeah.
I remember as a medical student in my earliest days, we practiced putting the film up to look cool, like one of my medical school moments with my friends. Like, that was that time.
Oh, yeah. And like, what's in this guy's brain? Like, I don't know. I left them on the elevator, right? I left it on the subway.
Totally.
So, and now it's changed, right? All those pictures are collected, are compiled into bits and bytes in a computer, and then radiologists can read it from anywhere. And I think that's great. You know, in the middle of the night, I have an interesting case. I need some help looking at a CAT scan. At 1 a.m, you know, I can wake somebody up who bleary-eyed, gets out of bed, goes on their computer and tells me what they see, which is amazing. But I've also heard of these radiology boats or yachts where there's a bunch of radiologists and they have all that technology on the bottom of the boat and they're kind of cruising the Caribbean and everyone takes turns covering the CAT scan or MRI and they're reading things remotely and sending it off to another place. Do you know if that's true?
I have no idea. It doesn't sound like if you can read scans anywhere, why would you do it on a boat? Like it doesn't, but who knows? Like, that's the interesting thing about the world is it's a bizarre, at the fringes of the world, it gets pretty bizarre.
Yeah. But like, if you think about that, you know, and radiologists reading things, these are humans looking at pictures. And I think about when you mentioned self-driving vehicles, right? And self-driving vehicles are amazing, but I still don't trust them. Right. I've been in my buddy's car and he likes showing me in his Tesla. He's like, look at this. We can just talk and I can press this button. And it's like, it's doing a good job though. This thing recognizes people on the road, it flashes lights when there's somebody walking their dog. So I'm like, hey, this is actually probably better than he's driving, but I still don't trust this robot. But then when I drive down the highway and I see this transport truck with those big chemical signals on it, you know, like the corrosive product and skull and crossbones, and I look at who's driving it, and it's some dude crushing energy drinks talking on his phone, I kind of wouldn't mind a robot driving that car.
Yeah. And what's so interesting, like if everybody just imagines the person that they know that's the worst driver, and then imagine them, they're driving and distracted. Like humans aren't very good at driving. And so there was a time where when somebody would go into an elevator, there was an elevator operator who would actually operate the elevator. And then there was a time where you didn't need the elevator operator. The elevators were safer and they worked without the human. But there was still a person in the elevator because people would be like, I can't get an elevator if there's not a human there. And then there's just a time where we just get into elevators. So we're just at this moment where, like, I don't know. I know some people that I'm nervous that they're on the road. And I'm not talking about patients or I'm just talking about, like, these are like friends and family and like people who drive. And I would prefer a world where there's going to be self-driving cars. And I believe there'll be a moment like horses where you only have a car. Like, nobody uses horses to get around in Canada, in the US, North America. You have a horse because you like horses. But that's the way it'll be with cars eventually. And there'll be a moment where you're not allowed to drive anymore on the highway. It'll be like, sorry, you're not allowed anymore to drive on the car because you're not, or your insurance is at it makes it such a huge premium, or there's places in the same way that you can't drive a horse on a road. There'll be a moment where you're not allowed to drive an old car without technology on the road. It takes time to happen.
No, the stakes are high. I find, like, I'll let a robot vacuum my floor, right? I'll let a robot cut the grass, whatever. I'm just not going to go on the lawn when that robot's doing its thing. You know, in terms of self-driving vehicles, like, I am okay with a self-driving transport truck because anecdotally, I feel that would be safer. But I don't know if I want a thing replacing my driving. Maybe sometimes I want to drive. And there's that cognitive dissonance that sometimes I can do it better. But what about in healthcare? Like, are we going to get to the point where computers just make decisions for us because we know it's better? Or are we never going to get over the fact that we want to have a human culpability aspect to this decision making?
Yeah, so technology is not always good too. Like, I want to talk about how it's bad in a way. But right now, our radiologists, we use AI to cue what scans we read. And there's AI that will look at bleeds and brains to supplement their reading. So that's like right now. So I know, like, we have amazing radiologists at Trillium. I'm really proud of this, of that department. And they've gone through a great journey to get to where they are. But the reality is I want my radiologist and I want the AI on top of it. Then it's going to be, you're not allowed to read without the AI, or your insurance payment is higher if you're not reading with the AI. Then it's going to be the AI is really doing most of the work, but we're keeping the doctors there because it's like the elevator person. And then there's a moment, I don't know when that moment is, it may be a long way away, where the AI is reading the scan. And the interesting thing between AI and humans is they make different mistakes. So they actually balance out quite when AI can make some horrendous mistakes. Humans make mistakes. They actually make different mistakes. Where I think it's interesting is if you're doing palliative care or you're in hospital or you're making trusted decisions, like in the back of a hospital where we're reading chemistry studies, people don't see that. But if you're about to make a decision about a cardiac surgery that's a life event, or you're having a conversation about life and death things, that trust, that therapeutic relationship, that care for the individual, that's very, very, that I believe that's really, really far away. And I think there's something really powerful in the human touch. There's something very powerful about the presence of human beings. And that is the bad side of technology. So if you look at the impact on mental health of social media, and you're seeing lawsuits start to happen, but social media use and phone use in teenagers is brutal. It is a massive generational problem. And we will look at it the same way that we did smoking and kids smoking and doctors giving cigarettes to pregnant women, which seems crazy, but that wasn't the 1950s. Everyone, relax, have a cigarette, you're pregnant. What we're seeing right now is a mental health cognitive presence issue and technology stripping away the human interaction on everything. That's everything from like having a good conversation to polarization of thinking, not allowing people to actually talk to each other, sitting in echo chambers where you would never say that to somebody, but you say it on the internet. There's a lot of bad things. It's that therapeutic human touch part and key decisions that I think is a long way away. But the back office stuff and the interpretive, it's already starting to happen.
Well, that's why I always, when I work with medical learners, medical students who are kind of trying to decide their careers, I always support decisions to go into what I do, internal medicine, primary care. and psychiatry. And they asked me, why those three? And I say, because all of those require in-person human communication. So we'll be the last ones to be taken over by robots. But I do feel that eventually, looking at where things are coming, perhaps there will be kind of silicon-based life forms or robots that are actually better at giving that therapeutic touch, because we've broken down how to break bad news to people. We have algorithms. We learned that in med school. Who's to say that an algorithm, a ChatGPT, can't learn to do that better and consistently? And, you know, I work with a lot of learners and trainees that sometimes I cringe when I watch them breaking bad news, and I coach and I support them. But there are some people who are never going to be great at that part of our job. And medical school and the selection process is largely grade heavy, right? It's your academic performance, it's your work ethic, et cetera. Obviously, there's a part of that human touch and that communication, but there's always people who slip by the goalie. So I wouldn't be surprised if in 30 years from now, I'm just telling prospective medical students to go into coding or something different. So you mentioned anti-aging. Right. And that's how I want to close out our conversation this morning is, you know, when I talked about those people on Instagram, you know, biohacking, right? That's a big word that comes up, you know, biohacking and intermittent fasting, intermittent sleeping, intermittent this, you know, photosensitivity, staring at the sun for 5 minutes every morning. Like all of these things are going to make you live longer. What is anti-aging to you?
So I think at the simplest part of the curve, you can see things that we know make you age and increase your risk at a higher level. And this is just fact. So if you smoke cigarettes, you will age faster than if you don't. If you drink a large amount of alcohol, your body is going to deteriorate at a higher rate. If you're sedentary, I mean, you're not walking around or doing exercise. So there's all these lifestyle things that are very clear that, again, you can get to the extreme of it. Of, you know, I'm going to do this type of exercise in this way. But, you know, we know as you age, you start to lose muscle mass. So if you start to exercise in a different way, lifting weights and using, and I'm not saying anybody, everyone should go out and lift weights. I'm just saying is there's a way to maintain your musculoskeletal frame in a better way and your genetics with less risk. Then you start moving into risk modification of inflammatory markers, cholesterol, blood, like taking care of your blood pressure really well is really, really important, but we don't do that. So then you start to get into the things that we all know as doctors and people are really important, your cholesterol, your blood pressure, you know, making sure that you're being screened for your cancers. This is also saving your lifespan. Then you're starting to move into the realm of where things are starting to happen now, where you get into medications that might affect your weight, like Ozempic and other things. You're getting into metformin as a medication. You're getting into other types of supplements that we're really not sure how good they are, but they're starting to show progress. And then I believe there's a space that is lifestyle, everything from cold immersion and other things that we're figuring out to medications that I believe everyone should be on the right medications, the right risk factor, the right exercise programs. But you will start to see people taking medications for the purpose of aging. Why are you on this medication? Because I have diabetes. Why are you on this medication? Because it actually prevents the decline of my body in aging. And you're starting to see studies like with metformin as an example. I'm not saying take metformin. I'm just simply saying you're starting to see legitimate scientific proof that there are things that you can take that aren't for a disease. And that is actually the emergence of a domain. So you take that and then you take really good monitoring of people where it's, hey, Mark, I can see you're off track. We're not going to let you get off track. We're going to take care of you before you get sick. These are the, you know, you do oil changes in your car. Doing oil changes is really important for the longevity of your car. Those oil changes are going to come in healthcare. And that little button that goes on your screen that says, go to the mechanic, that's coming for healthcare. And it's here for a lot of people. Those two things, that those two concepts coming to healthcare are revolutionary because you don't have to get sick and go to your doctor and say, there's something wrong with me. And then they're searching around and they're like, oh, you got this. There's blood tests that will say you have a high risk of pancreatic cancer. We're now going to do things to you to minimize that risk. You have a very high risk of X. we're going to intervene on that. We're going to give you life back. And so I think, you know, you converge all these things together. There's always risks with technology. There's, you can do more scans on people and then you do more procedures and then you cause more anxiety and you cause more, like, absolutely, there's risks and benefits of it. But I do believe we are at a moment where the actual concept of healthcare is changing. And that paradigm shift is massive. From I only go to my doctor when I'm sick and I wait in their office, or I go to the Emerge, to my doctor's the best because they prevent me from getting sick.
Well, it's, the mechanic analogy is great, because if you own a vehicle, you take care of it. You know, you put winter tires on in the winter, you might do rust proofing, you change the filters, and then you take it to the mechanic. And when I look at that analogy to visiting your primary care physician or nurse practitioner, it's about checking your blood, all these things we know, right? Like those oil light flashing on, we know that if you don't control your blood pressure, you're going to have a higher risk of stroke and heart disease. If we don't control your cholesterol panel, you're going to have a higher risk of those things. If you have a family history of colorectal cancer, we should get up in your butt with a colonoscope and screen you for that. And so what you're describing is a future where we have a lot more information about what earlier things we should look for to mitigate downstream risk. But as it stands right now in 2024, we don't have much else outside of what we currently have at this moment to say, yeah, you should do a cold plunge every day, or you should be chugging metformin and eating tons of vitamin B6. Like, there's lots of stuff out there. There's lots of noise, but nothing has been rigorously proven. But perhaps in the future, we may be prescribing some of these things. But I look at that general maintenance, you know, sleep hygiene, adequate nutrition, stress management, social connectivity.
Absolutely.
And then screening for these chronic diseases is a good place to start.
Yeah. And I think what you're going to find, there's ProMed AI, which is a really interesting company that's forming, which, and it's led by the people who created the algorithms for drug testing, like for drug interactions. So there was just a recent article in The Guardian around this, is doctors, we can prescribe over 3,500 medications. And every one of those medications has a side effect, a kidney dose, and an interaction with other medications. Doctors can't keep that in their brain. It's impossible. Most doctors really only prescribe somewhere between 50 to 75 medications and then 25 rare. So this algorithm actually helps doctors make the best decision on how to give medications. That's coming in everywhere. So you're going to have your own doctor. Mark, you're going to have your thing that says, Mark, for you, this is what's right for you. Here's your genetic profile. Here's your molecular markers. Here's your inflammatory markers. Here's some things that we know you should not do. Like, or here's cholesterol. Your blood pressure's a little bit off, but it's going to take really good care of you. By the way, you haven't had a tetanus vaccine. Who's worrying about all the tetanus vaccines that haven't happened for people? Because nobody's actually doing that. Because the only time you go see your doctor, if you can get in, is when you're really sick. So nobody's actually, there's all these things that we know people should get. They're not getting it. But you're going to have your own platform. And that's a great place to be, because that then takes the burden off of the system and allows us to focus on more complicated situations, and then for innovation to happen across the system. And there's a lot of really exciting things happening across the system.
So what I hear talking with you today, and thanks again for taking the time out of what sounds like an insane schedule to join me this morning. What I hear from you is the future of healthcare looks bright. Innovation looks very promising. And it's definitely going to be an interesting 5, 10, 15, 20 years ahead. And hopefully this will lead to better health outcomes for all of our population and population globally. So thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. And I'll let you go back and slay in your corporate medical world.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to sit down and have a conversation with Dr. Dante Mora. The analogies, the comparisons, the anecdotes from the blockbuster video to Netflix dynamic to self-driving cars and revolutionizing healthcare. I find that he always has a very simple and relatable way of explaining things that are really, really complicated. And that really gives me promise and hope as to what the future of healthcare globally, and then also in my country in Canada, is going to look like. Obviously, we covered a lot of different themes and topics today. The future of AI in medicine and healthcare, the future of personalized healthcare, you know, looking at how our bodies metabolize or digest different medications, how our genetics kind of predisposes us to various treatments, maybe some treatments to lower your cholesterol are better for some people based on their genetic profile. Maybe for other people, they need a certain medication and you need to be mindful of different interactions. The future is certainly going to be very interesting and very bright. But I also look to that dark side there that he talked about. We covered some of the downstream impacts that can be detrimental to technological interventions, the need for human touch and therapeutic alliance, but also the dangers that can happen with private industry, especially if you're not careful. And I know as a podcaster and someone who listens to a lot of different podcasts, when I was interested in creating a podcast, I wanted to find that middle ground. I felt that a lot of the podcasts out there in the health and medicine field, they were of two extremes. One extreme was very sciencey, very poindextery. You know, the stuff I listen to when I'm getting ready to provide patient care. What are the current treatment guidelines for severe pneumonia? Somebody who's on a ventilator. When do we decide when to take them off? Basically, no different than a med school lecture. So there's those podcasts that are out there that are great and very helpful at developing that medical expertise and making sure that I'm on top of my game. But on the other side is a lot of this wishy-washy, sit in the cold plunge pool for an hour every morning and then get up and take these various supplements over here. Wake yourself up every hour and do segmented sleep. And all of these things are going to make you live longer and be healthy. And a lot of it's hokey pokey and not rooted in evidence. And what I wanted to cover in the podcast here was a mix of those two. Provide some general medical information to arm our listening public, who by and large are the general public, with some general information that is evidence-based, that works, that can help them, while also helping to filter out some of that stuff that you may see on social media and online. And by and large, a lot of these things that you're going to hear about and see about, cold plunges, the carnivore diet, taking various supplements, sure, it may create a narrative if people sell it properly, that this can help you and this can make you live longer and healthier. But a lot of it hasn't been proven. But sitting right in front of us are all of these wonderful tools, looking at your blood pressure, looking at your cholesterol profile, looking at the amount of time you spend sitting in a chair and increasing those healthy habits, improving the quality of your sleep, screening for conditions like sleep apnea, screening for conditions like cancers if you're predisposed based on your family history. We have a lot of wonderful evidence out there that outlines the importance and the value of doing those things, but sometimes it's the access to that screening and that ongoing conversation and that check-in with your primary care provider that's lacking. So I think for everybody out there in the listening audience, make sure that you're seeing your healthcare provider regularly or as regularly as you can. Read up about some of the conditions that may exist in yourself and in your family to make sure that you're being screened. So some good ongoing maintenance of your vehicle, drawing on that mechanics analogy, is something that's going to be certainly very helpful. But looking at the future, I think we definitely have a very bright, interesting, and dynamic time ahead. It's great to know that people like Dr. Dante Mora are leading that charge and are working with people to improve the healthcare for all of us. Moving forward into the future, I think we definitely have some interesting times ahead. I hope that that conversation was stimulating for all of you. Thanks again to everybody for listening. Thanks again to my team, my family, for supporting me in this endeavor. And I hope that you had a great time listening in. We'll see you all next week. Thanks for listening to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Bonta, the home of science-based skepticism. Tune in next Wednesday for another healthcare conversation. For more information, please visit labcoat.fm.